The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're going to start off this time with a reading of one of Oprah's intentions. She puts this out weekly to her Oprah readers. This one is called Oprah Shares an Update from Maui. Every week, Oprah is setting an intention exclusively for Oprah Daily Insiders with reflections on topics like letting go, forgiveness, coming into your own, and more. Hey everybody, another week, we got through it, and there were some improvements. A lot of people got moved from shelter spaces to hotels this week here in Maui. I started the week visiting pop-up shelter hubs where canned goods, clothes, diapers, and other useful items were being manned by a lot of really committed volunteer community leaders. At each hub, I asked people to tell me what they needed. At one, they said they needed solar-powered generators. So I spent most of the week trying to locate solar-powered generators. There were none on island, so off-island, shipped, still not here. At another hub, there was a volunteer, Jamie, who's a teacher. She said, "You know, what we really need is fresh underwear in all the sizes. And I couldn't find enough in all sizes shopping. So I called the Hanes Company, and they said, 'Yes, we are so happy to ship you 2.1 million units.' I said, 'Whoa, hold up, wait a minute. That is a lot of shorts, a lot of panties, a lot of bras. Thank you so much for your generosity, but I think we could do with a lot less, like maybe 50,000 units would work for now. Still don't know if all that's going to fit in my truck to deliver. Maybe it'll take a few truckloads. This is what happens every day. I'm just trying to stay open and flexible." This morning, I got a call from Kanani, who was a volunteer who I met in the very first shelter. She needed a Polaris and a flatbed and some tents so that workers wouldn't have to stand out in the sun. So I'm just trying to provide and be open wherever possible. Each day presents itself with a new set of challenges and obstacles to try to overcome. From what I've seen and experienced, people's spirits are still strong and ready to rise. Last week, I told you about Julius, the young man who felt his skin popping running through the fire. Turns out he was also carrying an elderly woman on his back. He's doing really well. He's at a facility. He's been moved where his bandages get changed every day and people are looking after him. We speak regularly. He sends me texts every morning saying, "Hope your day is beautiful, ma'am. Take care of yourself." And I went to visit him yesterday. He is still smiling. So if he can, we can too. Bless your week, everybody. Go well. Okay, we have finished with the intentions and we're heading over into lifestyle. This article is It's Never Too Late to Unlock Your Inner Creative. A transformation coach dares you, yes you, to try something scary and new. There's a portal that opens as life's second half comes into focus. For me, it started just before turning 48 and kicked in at 49. The most cuspy year, as demonstrated by its Roman numeral XLIX, 50 minus 10, and 10 minus 1. It's a potent edge. I know this because back in my 30s, I experienced a full flame out and leaving my first marriage, quitting my job as a magazine editor in Paris, and with only my overstuffed backpack as ballast, dropping into the meditation scene in India, following the spiritualized expat pack from Theravanamalai to Varanasi and Bodhgaya to Dhirumshala for a year. This wasn't that. Not a high-drama midlife crisis fueled by volatility. This later call beckoned gently toward the unknown and a future that seemed enticing, not existentially fraught. Instead of wondering what I should do, a question that haunted me in my 30s, My thoughts danced around what I could do. I could keep writing. I'd published several books and had been freelancing ever since India. I felt like I could do almost anything. My inner inquiry was bolstered by a sense of confidence I'd known only fleetingly in the past. In reality, however, I had very few clues. The only thing I knew, and this was a whisper of an inkling, was that I was also curious about what would happen if I got into really good shape. What would it be like to be nimble and buoyant? If I moved differently, if my cells were rearranged, would I think differently too? So that's where I began in 2018. I nudged the furniture out of the way, unrolled my yoga mat, and joined Taryn Toomey's high-octane online HIIT workout, the class for an impossible series of soaring jumping jacks. My breath was jagged, my heart pounded plaintively, my cheeks burned, and I kept on going, even when my arms went slack, muscles aflame. I found a tangible intensity reflecting all over the big movements in my psyche, and I burst into tears. I didn't give up, however. My curiosity held me. I logged in day after day, and over time, my body did take on a new shape, allowing a fresh energy to ripple through. A fleet of further what-ifs followed. What if I cleaned up my diet and cut sugar? Would fascia rolling change me? I bought an Oura ring, that's O-U-R-A, to track my sleep and experimented with everything from microdosing psilocybin to bioidentical HRT to cold plunging in the wintry Atlantic to hyperbaric oxygen therapy. It wasn't strategic career planning, but something was happening. In the meantime, I kept up my pursuits as a writer, though I was much more excited by my hobbies than my assignments. Then, after more than a year of tinkering, I did what would have been once unthinkable. I scheduled a call with an editor who had commissioned me to write a stylish nonfiction book and told her I couldn't complete the contract. I could, but I wouldn't. My heart just wasn't in it. As I wrote a personal check to Penguin Random House returning my advance, I felt surprisingly serene. Truly in the unknown now, free from this constraint and with enough money saved to keep our finances rolling, a radical new idea started to form. Would I ever merge all my interests into one and become a transformational coach? Out of all my homegrown experimentation, something novel had emerged. In some respects, my pivot was lightning fast. I took a year to train as a wellness coach, packing in classes in somatic therapies, working with several coaches of my own, and deepening my newfound knowledge of physiological complexity. But in other ways, my approach to helping clients, mostly visual artists, fashion people, and writers of every kind, engage more deeply with their creative pursuits was decades in the making. I rely on my journalist's acute curiosity and interviewing skills, my writer's understanding of the creative process, my extensive meditation and mindfulness experience, and even my capacities as a parent. Today we take on the big stuff, the second act pivot, a change of artistic medium, transcending writer's blocks or the tender completion of an intense memoir. We start where I began my pivot, with support to regulate the nervous system. Since thoughts of change alone can kick up adrenaline, shifting you into fight or flight mode, in that state, your creativity is literally very limited. Your choices are narrowed by the neuromodulators in your system. Creative people are like athletes. The steadiness of their bodies is linked to the expansive brilliance of their minds. Rest, eating well, and movement all matter. So does calming down. From my perspective, it's all the same. How you sleep is how you write or paint. So if you're daring yourself to take your own creativity further, here are some avenues I explore with clients almost universally to get started. Number one, see beauty everywhere. Creative people do this naturally, but most have forgotten to lean in and amplify all the sensual pleasures that help the body know it's safe. Consciously savoring things all day long, when something tastes good, while slowly smoothing on body oil after a shower makes a difference. I had a client who took photos of the trees in her neighborhood just because they were gorgeous, though as an artist, she would have found this trite before working with me. It liberated her process. Regulating your emotions could be as simple as looking around wherever you are and noticing two or three things you like, a patch of sky, a color. It's an override for the internal alarm system. Everything is okay. Number two, rebel against deep grind work habits. Coaching longtime creative professionals requires a respectful acknowledgement of their sensitivity. Physiologically, the body functions optimally when working in uninterrupted blocks of around an hour. If the content of the work is emotionally charged, then restorative breaks, meditation, walks, naps, a bath, listening to music are all the more essential to allowing new ideas to form in a way that's sustainable. An incredibly talented TV screenwriter I collaborated with had to exercise the ways of the writer's room, the endless sessions, the harsh atmosphere, in order to work more deeply. Number three, honor time and space. Though creativity functions in the etheric realm, I also help clients investigate the bedrock foundations of time and space. What work environment truly suits you? A super tidy writing desk or a sculpture studio full of inspiring chaos? A memoirist comes out of writer's block found she preferred dictating her pages while walking through the New Mexico woods rather than facing a blank page in her office. Time, too, requires minute awareness. An actress becoming a playwright forged a new way to structure her creative time as distinct from a schedule dictated by a director's call sheet. I once helped a working mom and gallery owner ruthlessly clear time during the winters when her gallery was closing, and she could devote long days to her artistic studio work. It all boils down to articulating what you uniquely want most, which has to matter more than the obstacles entangling you on the physical plane. 4. Be generous about other people's opinions. One aspect of transformation that feels insurmountable for almost everyone is a nagging fear of what others will think. Many friends don't want us ever to change, since brains tend to like things just as they are, predictable and safe. So here's another place to get precise and ruthless with your boundaries, which, thankfully, is so much easier when cruising toward 50. Simply allow other people to think whatever they want about you. If you're a naturally giving person, this feels pretty delightful. Let them think what they want. Better yet, don't tell anyone what you're working on until it's solid and solidly yours. Savor your own mystery. There's a reason you don't bring your new love home to your parents after a second date. Number 5, let curiosity chart the course. Creativity is always a leap into the void. As I once read, any great literary work should have an ending that feels surprising yet inevitable. This is also true of a latent life re-envisioning. If the capacity to stay steady through turbulence is a gift of age, harnessing that tension to reveal something that surprises even you on the page, on the canvas, in your life trajectory, is beautifully creative. You might even start now, letting your eyes drift to the ceiling, or the sky or the stars, as you say to yourself, "I wonder." There's no answer yet. Don't fill in the blank. But if it feels delicious, and if your creative heart is in it, you may already feel a little electric charge run through you. Your curiosity-driven dopamine system recruited in service to your new exploration. Savoring that sensation of the adventurous unknown is a beautiful place to begin. So we are going to stay in lifestyle and move on to this article. Here's why some adults are attention seekers. Don't give in to the drama. We've all got that one friend who seeks validation through social media or comes off as needy. You know who they are. They label themselves as drama queens to create normalcy and acceptance for their behavior, masking a host of issues you may perceive as simply who they are and not what they've become. It could be your friend, child, or even parent who drives them to act like this. And when do you intervene? Learn how to cope, prevent, and work through attention-seeking behavior with our expert medical advice. What is the root cause of attention-seeking behavior? It's always good to look at it from biological and psychological perspectives, says Marcos Quafinos, that's Quafinones, a clinical social worker and founder of FIDI therapy, F-I-D-I therapy. When someone seeks attention, they are doing so to satisfy an insecurity. It can be genetic or a mood disorder or brought on by experiential traumas. However, the heart of the issue always leads back to anxiety. Anxiety is a normal feeling we all experience, but if it's weaponized to control and manipulate others, we have a very different issue on our hands. What personality type is attention-seeking? Be wary of people who have self-deprecating traits and seek validation or ask questions that always reflect attention to them. They may also brag incessantly about their physical appearance, wealth, or latest relationship, or have a flair for theatrics and drama 24/7. Their actions provoke you to focus on them, and they may not even recognize their manipulative behavior because it's so ingrained. Is attention-seeking a trauma response? There is always the possibility of unresolved trauma at the core of an issue. It could also be a response developed over time to soothe anxiety. Traumatic experiences are stored in the body, putting it into fight or flight mode, Quofinos explains. It could be because their parents didn't give them consistent attention as they were being raised, known as ambivalent and attachment, so they crave attention. Or it could be a general discomfort with themselves, and therefore they need to focus on someone or something other than themselves. Either way, the condition has a root in anxiety. How should I deal with someone's attention-seeking behavior? When a person is seeking attention, they are seeking validation. Waiting for their desired response causes great anticipation, which sets off anxiety. That anxiety is soothed only after receiving their desired response. Once it's received, they begin all over again, a dangerous cyclical chain reaction. The way to deal with attention-seeking behavior is not to reinforce it. By not reinforcing any behavior, the behavior can be extinguished, says Quofinos. Reinforce good behavior by sharing positive attention with them, unsolicited by their acting out, and through ways that encourage them to quit their unhealthy patterns. This can help foster change down the line. If it continues to get worse, encourage them to seek medical help from a therapist or psychologist to understand the root of the problem better. Everyone deserves to be happy in this life, including you, the friend who lends their ear. Okay, going on in lifestyle, I thought we'd put in a couple recipes that you might want to try. This first one, try this smoky split chicken with automatic brine. You'll enjoy this recipe from Sundays with Sophie by Bobby Flay with Amelia Timberlake, and it's the inspiration from Sophie Flay. The aroma of chicken cooking outdoors is one of my favorites. I may have to create a cologne out of it at some point. It's the smell of slowly cooking crispy skin combined with the smokiness of the wood-burning grill that gets your neighbors to come by to say hi. I use the term automatic brine or automatic marinade to signify that there's no waiting time before you cook. Just hit the chicken with brine and get started. So this recipe has four servings. The ingredients: 3 cups of applewood or cherrywood chips, 2 1.5-pound bone-in, skin-on chicken halves. For the automatic brine, you need 1/2 cup of apple cider vinegar, 1/4 cup of honey, 1/2 teaspoon of celery seeds, 3/4 teaspoon of cayenne pepper, 2 teaspoons of smoked paprika, 2 teaspoons of kosher salt, 1/2 teaspoon of freshly ground black pepper. To finish, you need 1 tablespoon of neutral oil such as avocado or canola, kosher salt and freshly ground black pepper, 2 cups of apple juice, 4 garlic cloves lightly smashed, and pantry barbecue sauce for serving. And here are the directions. Step 1. Soak the wood chips in cold water for 1 to 2 hours. Remove the chicken from the refrigerator 30 minutes before grilling to take the chill off. Step 2. Make the automatic brine. In a small bowl, combine the vinegar, honey, celery seeds, cayenne, paprika, salt, and black pepper. Step 3. To finish, use the tip of a sharp knife to poke holes throughout the chicken. Brush the chicken halves all over with the neutral oil and season with salt and pepper. In a heavy medium disposable pan, combine 1 cup of water, the apple juice, and garlic. Step 4. Prepare a kettle grill with charcoal off to one side for indirect grilling and add the soaked wood chips over the coals. Put the disposable pan of steaming liquid on the bottom grate of the grill on the opposite side of the coals. Put the top grate on and close the lid of the grill to heat well. Put the chicken half skinned down side on the grill directly over the hot coals and cook covered with golden brown and the skin is lightly crispy. 8 to 12 minutes. Flip and cook on the second side until lightly browned, 4 to 6 minutes. Step 5. Move the chicken to the cooler side of the grill over the pan of liquid. Liberally brush with some of the automatic brine. Put the lid of the grill on and open the vents on top halfway. Cook until the chicken reaches an internal temperature of 160 degrees Fahrenheit. That's 1 hour to 1 hour and 30 minutes. Turning the chicken and brushing it with the brine every 15 minutes. Add additional briquettes as needed to keep the internal temperature of the grill between 225 Fahrenheit and 250 Fahrenheit, and add additional water to the pan of steaming liquid if it is running low. Step 6. Once the chicken is fully cooked, brush it one last time with the brine. Then flip it so that it is skin side down and move it directly over the coals to cook until the skin is charred in spots, about 5 minutes. Step 7. Transfer the chicken halves to a platter and allow them to rest for 10 minutes before serving with the barbecue sauce. There's also a variation if you're cooking on a gas grill. Put the soaked wood chips into a smoke box or onto a large piece of heavy-duty foil. Fold the foil over the wood chips and seal the edges of the foil to make a packet. Use the tip of a knife or kitchen shears to poke several vents in the top. Lift up the grates on the right side of the grill and place the packet directly on the heat source of the grill and then return the grates. Then close the lid and turn the heat for the right side of the grill to medium high until you start to see smoke coming out of the grill. That takes about 20 minutes. Cook the chicken as directed in steps 4 and 5. Adjusting the heat as needed to maintain an internal grill temperature between 225 Fahrenheit and 250 Fahrenheit, and adding additional water to the steaming liquid if it is running low. Once the chicken is fully cooked, transfer it to a baking sheet and turn to the left side of the grill to medium high. Once the left side of the grill is hot, brush the chicken a last time with the brine and flip it so that it is skin side down and grill until the skin is charred in spots, about 5 minutes. Okay, we're moving on. This article is Let's Talk About Black and White Thinking. We spoke to a psychologist about why we tend to think in extremes and how to explore the gray area. We've all succumbed to black and white thinking at some point in our lives. Whether consciously or not, we've seen a situation as good or bad, right or wrong, happy or sad. And in doing so, we've eliminated an entire third world of possibilities. The gray area. It's in the gray area that life actually happens. We asked Hedy Syker Kiderling, PhD, how to move beyond black and white thinking and tap into that gray area. So what is black and white thinking? Black and white thinking is also known as dichotomous thinking and is often referred to as splitting. According to Syker Kiderling, black and white thinking is a thought process in which people think in absolutes, good or bad, success or failure, perfect or imperfect. It's a thought pattern people fall into to describe people, things, or actions. What are the signs and causes? Extreme terminology is one exhibit of black and white thinking. You may catch yourself or someone else saying words like always, never, perfect, terrible, good, or bad. Perfectionism and negative self-talk also can be signs that this thinking can stem from a learned habit rooted in trauma. Is black and white thinking harmful? Many people demonstrate black and white thinking at times or for certain issues, but if it becomes a pattern and persists across many areas of one's life, it could be part of a more serious condition. Syker Kiderling says, for instance, black and white thinking is commonly associated with narcissism, anxiety and depression, borderline personality disorder, and obsessive compulsive disorder. If it is your sole way of thinking, it can have grave effects on your relationships, career, or everyday life, Syker Kiderling says. Again, this is why embracing the gray areas is so important, Psyker Kiderling says. Communicating with others and building relationships takes seeing the gray. Healthy social relationships and work relationships require recognizing the nuances in life. Is black and white thinking a symptom of bipolar disorder? Typically, black and white thinking is more often a symptom of borderline personality disorder rather than bipolar disorder. It's important to recognize that this isn't always the case, and each situation should be assessed differently by a professional. Every disorder has criteria, and in order to meet that criteria, one symptom is not enough to create a diagnosis. How can you overcome it? Well, the most common way to curb black and white thinking is therapy, says Psyker Kiderling. Seeking counseling or a therapist to help identify the greater problem is essential. People with this type of thought pattern can benefit from learning how to identify when and why it is occurring. This work can be furthered with tools such as cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness, and other techniques to create more positive patterns of thinking. If there's a severe mental disorder causing it, then a more involved form of treatment may be required. Just as we have discussed the necessity of considering the gray area, it's critical to apply this consideration to black and white thinking as a concept itself. This type of thought pattern occurs on a spectrum. Recognizing the wide range of ways that black and white thinking can present itself is essential in overcoming it. Okay, we are moving on in culture and news. Five surprising facts about Anderson Cooper. A look at some of the details that have shaped the CNN broadcaster's past and present. For decades, Anderson Cooper has made waves in the journalism industry as a CNN anchor, a correspondent for 60 Minutes, and even as a special correspondent for the Oprah Winfrey Show. We've rounded up some notable facts about the news anchor and author's personal life that will help you understand who he is today, and including the fact that his firstborn son just turned 3. Wyatt is named after Cooper's father and was born by a surrogate in 2020. His family has famous roots in American history. Anderson is part of the famed Vanderbilt family. He's the son of the late Gloria Vanderbilt, who was an heiress and the great-great-granddaughter Cornelius Vanderbilt, the 19th century business railroad steamship magnate. There were statues of my great-great-great-grandfather Cornelius in New York, Cooper said in 26. I actually thought as a kid that everyone's grandparents turned into a statue when they died. The Vanderbilt influence is wide-ranging. The university that bears his last name was founded in Nashville in 1873, thanks to $1 million donation and a scholarship is also named after him. Cooper told CBS more about his great-great-great-grandfather in 2021. Well, that's what's so crazy, is he built two massive empires. It was late in life when he decided steamships were the past and railroads were the future. And he started buying up all small railroads around the Northeast, and eventually he formed a railroad company that basically was all rail service on the eastern seaboard to Chicago. CBS reports that Cornelius had a $100 million fortune when he died in 1877, and Cooper put this further into perspective. He had more money than the U.S. Treasury. But Cooper wasn't always a fan of his family's past. I felt like no good would come of me paying attention to them, he told CBS. The Vanderbilts when I was a kid seemed kind of like layabouts. I knew they had all these houses and they were in museums now, but it had no reality in my life. Despite his famous family connections, Cooper is no stranger to tragedy and hardship. His father, screenwriter and author Wyatt Cooper, passed away during a medical procedure when Cooper was just 10. He also lost his brother, Carter, to suicide in 1988. He had a close relationship with his mother, Gloria, who was a fashion designer and an artist, before her passing in 2019, and he eulogized her on CNN. Cooper was inspired to learn more about his complicated family history after his mother's passing and his first child's birth. He even co-authored the 2021 book Vanderbilt with Catherine Howe. He has two adorable sons named Wyatt and Sebastian. As a gay kid, I never thought it would be possible to have a child, and I'm grateful for all those who have paved the way and for the doctors and nurses and everyone involved in my son's birth. he shared in an Instagram post after Wyatt's birth. Cooper also co-parents alongside his ex-boyfriend, Benjamin Mazzini, when the pair had Sebastian Luke Mazzini Cooper together in 2022. He announced that Mazzini also was also in the process of adopting Wyatt, whose last name would become Mazzini Cooper, and said they've been raising Wyatt together. He's close friends with Andy Cohen. They've toured as a pair and are known for hosting CNN's New Year's Eve special live in Times Square and having fun while doing it. Here's hoping that their kids also share a strong bond. In a 2020 Father's Day episode of Watch What Happens Live, Wyatt and Cohen's son, Benjamin, met for the first time virtually. Books play a special role in his life. Cooper has written several books, including the 2017 title The Rainbow Comes and Goes, which he co-authored with his mom. While sharing some of his favorite books with Oprah.com in 2010, he talked about the influence reading had on him growing up. As a child, I had a problem reading. I had a mild form of dyslexia where I would see some letters backwards, and I had to go to a special reading instructor. One way she helped was to encourage me to find books that I was really passionate about. A few of his favorite titles were It Seemed Important at the Time by his mother, Gloria Vanderbilt, and Families by his father, Wyatt Cooper. As he told O, the Oprah magazine, in 2005, Families felt like a letter to me from him, since it focuses on his father's family and childhood and the one he created as an adult. He doesn't shy away from discussing grief. In fact, it's the subject of his moving CNN podcast, All There Is with Anderson Cooper, which launched in 2022. When the first season of the podcast wrapped, Cooper shared on Instagram that more than 1,000 people had left voicemails for him on what grief taught them and what helped them cope. And still in culture and news, Adam Sandler sends Jennifer Aniston flowers every Mother's Day after her IVF battle. The actors have the most wholesome friendship. Jennifer Aniston has some good friends by her side. In a new interview, the Friends alum revealed how longtime pal Adam Sandler lets her know she's loved, especially on her hardest days. Speaking to the Wall Street Journal about Sandler and their time filming 2019's murder mystery together, Aniston's production company Echo Films produced this year's Murder Mystery 2. Aniston said Sandler and his wife Jackie have sent her flowers every Mother's Day after learning about her fertility struggles. The actors have been close for decades, having filmed not only the murder mystery movies together, but also 2011 rom-com Just Go With It. Aniston does not have children, and in a 2022 interview with Allure, opened up about her attempt to conceive some years ago. "I was trying to get pregnant. It was a challenging road for me, the baby-making road," she said, explaining that she went through rounds of in vitro fertilization, drank Chinese teas, and threw everything at solving her infertility. "Still, it did not work. I would have given anything if someone had said to me, 'Freeze your eggs, do yourself a favor.' You just don't think it. So here I am today, and the ship has sailed," she added. In the interview, the actor also slammed speculation that her marriages to fellow actors Brad Pitt and Justin Theroux didn't work out because she wouldn't have children. "I just cared about my career, and God forbid a woman is successful and doesn't have a child," she said. "And the reason my husband left me, why we broke up and ended our marriage, was because I wouldn't give him a kid. It was absolute lies. I don't have anything to hide at this point." And keeping in culture and news, Zendaya on keeping her Tom Holland romance private. It's about protecting the peace. The actress addresses how her increasing fame has changed how she navigates her day-to-day life. While Zendaya has dealt with fame for years due to her Disney Channel child stardom, the shift to being a grown-up, massively successful A-list celeb has come with some growing pains, namely navigating paparazzi and greatly reduced privacy. Zendaya spoke to Elle about what she noticed her day-to-day life shifting, pinpointing it to the spring of 2022 when she was filming The Challengers in Boston. She also explained why she has continued to keep her relationship with Spider-Man co-star Tom Holland as private as possible, admitting that they accept that they cannot hide everything. Zendaya has been asked about a May 2023 photo of her and Holland on a boat ride in Venice, and if the interest coming from fans admiring their relationship helps make it a little easier to accept. Parts of my life I accept are going to be public, she replied. I can't not be a person and live my life and love the person I love. But also, I do have control over what I choose to share. It's about protecting the peace and letting things be your own, but also not being afraid to exist. You can't hide. That's not fun either. I am navigating it more than ever now. Regarding the attention shift, Zendaya explained that she noticed after the last Spider-Man and the last season of Euphoria, there was a visceral change. Before, I could get away with going places and getting in and out. But in Boston last spring, I would end up going right back home because it was really overstimulating. Everybody would go hang out at a bar or something, and I'd be like, I'd love to, but I think I could ruin everybody's night because it's just not going to be fun once I'm there. She continued to test the boundaries of what she can do publicly on that Venice trip where she was photographed walking her dog Noon. I had this idea of, like, can I walk around Venice? No, I can't, she said with a laugh. I had to pick up his poo, and I was like, Lord, please don't take a picture of me picking up my dog's poo. There's a picture of me holding the bag, but thankfully they spared the grabbing and the putting it in the bag part. Parts of this article were edited due to time. This next article is over in Lifestyle. Why do I keep crying about the same thing? Tears can be a sign that you are actually healing from your trauma, not that you are stuck in the past. The grocery store checkout line was wrapping around the produce section one Saturday morning, and the very pregnant woman behind me looked hot and exhausted, so I motioned her to go ahead of me. As we commiserated about the summer heat, my heart began racing, and I could feel tiny sweat beads forming on my forehead, despite the store's Arctic AC. I smiled along, but my mind flashed back to the moment 17 years earlier, when my doctor, barely taking the time to look me in the eye, callously sentenced me to 5 months of pregnancy-related bed rest. I had unusually large fibroids, and she warned me that my baby might not survive. As this long-ago trauma washed over me like a tsunami, I made a mental list of all the things that would go wrong for the woman in front of me, who looked like she was smuggling a watermelon under her sweat-drenched shirt and could potentially give birth right there by the Tic Tac rack. By the time she began putting her items on the conveyor belt, I was so worried for her health and safety that I began feeling queasy. Logically, I knew that her experience would not be the same as mine, and my son had turned out just fine. But I felt like I was right back in my doctor's office, hearing my own diagnosis all over again, paralyzed with fear. As I loaded up on my car in the parking lot moments later, I had to hold back my tears. Why couldn't I just feel joy for this woman? And why, after all these years, did I feel so helpless and terrified when I recalled my own difficult pregnancy? Why did it still have so much power over me? Turns out that my meltdown at the grocery store was a sign of progress. Tracy Shores, PhD, a professor in behavioral and systems neuroscience at Rutgers University and author of Everyday Trauma, considers this kind of event a normal stress response. I wasn't regressing into my past trauma, she told me. I was healing. Over time, she explains, the brain learns that just because you were exposed to a memory, it doesn't mean you have to be afraid. This resonated. It wasn't the first time the sight of a pregnant woman had triggered me, and it probably wouldn't be the last. To avoid a panic spiral, I just had to remind myself I was safe in the moment. A very helpful tactic, says Olivia Rems, PhD, mental health researcher at the University of Cambridge, and author of This Is How You Grow After Trauma, is pinpointing what your triggers are. Knowledge is power, she says. The more we become aware of our patterns, the more we are in a position to change them. So how can you tell if you're moving forward even when it feels like you're taking a million steps backward? Here are three self-defeating thoughts that actually show your healing. Negative thought. I'm reliving a painful experience yet again. I must be stuck. Healthy translation. I'm aware of my body's stress response. I know it's natural. Sweat pours down your back. Your jaw clenches. Your muscles tense. This is a normal reaction when confronted with old wounds. Being aware of the brain-body connection and acknowledging that your racing heart and knotted stomach are just physical manifestations of a bad memory can dial down your anxiety and help the symptoms abate much more quickly. Shores suggests reminding yourself that a memory is just molecules that have created an image, but the experience itself is gone. Over time, your physical response to a painful memory will diminish as you remind your brain to stop being scared. Shores recommends a combination of aerobic exercise and meditation to feel less anxious and afraid. Exercise can produce feel-good endorphins, while meditation helps us slow down and become more aware of our thoughts and feelings. Negative thought. I still have moments of fear and indecision. Yep, definitely stuck. Healthy translation, I'm letting myself feel my feelings, that's how I'll heal. Letting yourself feel your feelings instead of suppressing them is a sure sign of growth. When you begin healing from trauma, you start to allow different complex feelings to emerge, Rems says. Instead of running away from your emotions and potentially turning to alcohol or substance abuse to numb or further suppress them, you allow yourself to move through them and emerge on the other side, hopefully free from pain, fear, and indecision. People have complicated, sometimes even contradicting emotions around their trauma. You may experience anger and sadness, but also feel grateful that you survived the experience. Being able to acknowledge this without guilt or shame is the key to moving forward, even if it takes years. Reminding yourself that the trauma happened in the past and that you are safe in the present moment can help you identify negative thoughts, acknowledging them, and then stop them from spinning out of control. Negative thought, I can't stop talking about what happened to me, I'm stuck in a loop. Healthy translation, I'm confiding in people I trust, I'm not hiding or suffering in silence. It can make you feel incredibly exposed to share your deepest, darkest secrets with others, but when you take a risk and make yourself vulnerable to people with whom you feel safe, two wonderful things happen. You release a huge amount of stress, and you create a sense of trust. Shedding tears can help release oxytocin and feel-good chemicals. The moment you let other people see the real you, this puts you in the position to get better. It's a sign that you're opening yourself up to the real world and allowing other people in, says Rems. Crying in front of your friends, your therapist, and other people you trust is not only cathartic, but also creates bonds and builds both a sense of community and a safety net. Maintaining strong connections has also been proven to help us navigate and ultimately move through difficult experiences. Next time you have a reaction to a past wound, don't isolate yourself. Instead, call a friend. Let them know you need support and unleash the cascade of tears. Traumatic events can be so devastating that it takes time for our brains to understand they are no longer harming us. Be kind and patient with yourself and accept the uncertainty you're feeling, Rem says. Meet yourself where you are. Okay, after that, we're heading back over into lifestyle. This article is The Gesture That Meant Everything in My Mom's Final Days. As the author's mother lay in hospice, a neighbor stopped by with a simple meal that felt like a lifeline. In the days following my mom's death, a variation of stick it in the freezer and pop it in the oven whenever you want messages appeared via text in a near constant stream. Within 24 hours, my dad's refrigerator and freezer were crammed with homemade gumbo and meatballs and chicken soup. We also got gigantic salads, platters of brownies, green bean casseroles, bagels and lox, fruit platters, sandwich trays, enchilada casseroles, and pizza. Things stacked up so quickly, it took us 10 minutes of stress and toil just to pull a jar of pickles out of the refrigerator without creating an avalanche of marinara sauce and queso. Good food is everything that grief is not. Celebratory, exciting, life-affirming, joyous. In the early days of grief, I could barely stomach a piece of plain toast, much less some lasagna or a large fajita platter. At some point during the long, oppressive days spent at my mom's hospital bedside before we brought her home for hospice, I remember being sent down to the cafeteria by my dad to take a break and get some food. It was the last thing I wanted, but breaks are necessary when you're sitting, waiting, listening to the beep of medical equipment and the roll of gurney wheels out in the hallway for hours on end. It's the most torturous kind of waiting, watching someone you love die. but all you can do is wait, and I guess eat, or try to. I reluctantly went looking for the cafeteria, grabbing a pale blue plastic tray as I entered. I walked past the mashed potatoes and the meatloaf and the cauldrons of gloppy soup, feeling queasy. The only thing that wound up on my plate was a pile of blanched green beans that looked as pathetic as I felt. They fit my mental and emotional state perfectly, but despite our cosmic link, they triggered something in me. It was all so awful. The quiet, drab cafeteria, the jaundiced glare of fluorescent lights, the disgusting green beans that looked like the very life had been sucked right out of them. And, of course, my mom, upstairs, barely speaking, unable to eat because of the tear in her colon, only waking to hallucinate a little boy in the corner, or, if I was lucky, to remember that I was her eldest daughter, take my hand and call me by my name. Before I even paid for the green beans, I called my husband, Jarrett, back in California. I needed to steady myself so I didn't wind up weeping on the cafeteria floor. "Are you okay?" he answered. "No, I'm not. I can't even look at my green beans." "Well, what's wrong with them?" "They're just so sad." "Can you get a sandwich instead?" "A sandwich won't help."
"Soup?"
"It's cream of mushroom. It's not about the soup. I'm not even hungry."
"Take some deep breaths. You're going to be okay."
"This is the worst feeling in the world. It hurts too much." I didn't fall to the floor, but I did weep, loud and hard, right there next to the cashier. Judging by her non-reaction, I'm sure she'd witnessed a similar scene many times before. I eventually pulled it together, paid up, and managed to eat a few bites. The green beans tasted like wet cardboard dusted with a single grain of salt. The flavor, or lack of flavor, didn't lift my mood or give me hope. But it did give me the strength to go back upstairs, face a reality I did not want, hold my mom's hand, and wait. A little over a week later, when my mom was home for hospice, I sat on a small white couch with my sister Amy, about a foot away from the bed that the hospice team had wheeled in for my mom. Most likely we were talking about how tired we both were and how we wanted this all to be over. But then again, we didn't, because that would mean only one thing. We weren't expecting anyone to come by, so when the doorbell rang, we forced ourselves up off the couch to see who it was. I hadn't seen Meredith, or Mrs. Griffiths, as I called her as a child, in years. I had practically grown up at her house, which was around the corner from my own, playing or spending the night with her daughter, my best friend, Lisa. I especially loved being at Lisa's house during the Christmas holidays. We made gingerbread houses by sticking graham crackers to the outside of milk cartons, using icing as glue. Being one of the lone Jewish kids in the neighborhood, their massive, sparkly tree rocked my world. And Meredith's food. Oh, the food. Homemade fudge, chocolate pecan pie, lemon bars, and beef brisket. Between the tinsel, the wooden nutcracker soldiers, and the sugar cookies, it was a magical place for a kid to hang out. Meredith and my mom were close, but in the last 10 or 15 years of her life, my mom had closed herself off from many of the friends she once knew and loved. My sister Jackie's alcoholism caused my mom to withdraw, and she found it hard to be as lively and social as she had once been. Still, despite the years of distance, there was Meredith, Mrs. Griffiths, standing at our door holding a large bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken. A bucket of KFC might sound like an odd thing to bring to a grieving family, but my memories of Mrs. Griffiths involved fine china, homemade fudge, liver pâtés, and heirloom snow sled ornaments. She was braised quail and champagne, not original recipe chicken and Dr. Pepper. But I guess I'd been wrong all those years. Or maybe she lightly dusted her KFC with rare truffle oil and served it on a bed of Belgian endive and Chervil's leaves. Amy and I opened the door, forcing ourselves to semi-smile and invite her in. Old Southern manners die hard, or more accurately, they never die, because you were raised to be polite, no matter how god-awful you felt. The bucket of chicken was thoughtful, but the kindest gesture was Meredith handing us the food and immediately saying, "You don't need to invite me in. I just wanted to bring this by. I love you, and I'm here if you need anything at all." And then, without waiting for us to answer, she hurried off. It was the most compassionate thing she could have done, letting us be,
not forcing us to interact or expand any more energy, offering her a drink or engaging in small talk. The simplicity of it was such a relief. As soon as we closed the door, Amy and I took that bucket of KFC into the kitchen, pulled off the top, and inhaled that greasy, glorious meal as if we were two naked and afraid contestants who had just finished a 40-day challenge in the jungles of Ecuador. The salt and fat and who knows what other sacred secret ingredients in there woke us up, revived us. It tasted so good. It was a moment of pleasure after so many moments spent feeling like a hollowed-out husk, going through the motions, dreading basically everything. How did Meredith know? Had someone brought KFC to her door when she was feeling sad? Was it her go-to culinary pick-me-up? She was a genius as far as I was and am concerned. Not just for the bucket of chicken, but for having the sense and sensitivity to leave us in peace. The joy was temporary, our grief alienated for a brief moment, but it is something I will never forget, the permission to forget, if only for the time it took to eat a few drumsticks. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Okay, we're going to add another recipe. This one is One Bowl Wonder Recipe Roasted Wild Mushroom and Bacon Pasta. Mushrooms are rich in B vitamins, which help the body utilize energy from other foods and produce oxygen-transporting red blood cells. This roasted wild mushroom and bacon pasta yields 4 servings. The ingredients: 12 ounces of pasta, we used rotini, 4 ounces of slices uncured bacon cut in pieces, 3 large shallots, thinly sliced, about 1 cup, 2 cloves of garlic, grated, 2 tablespoons of fresh thyme leaves, chopped, kosher salt and pepper, 2 pounds of mixed mushrooms, such as ashiitake, oyster, and hen of the woods, trimmed and sliced, 3 cups of baby spinach, 1/3 cup of dry sherry, and 3/4 cup of flat leaf parsley, roughly chopped. And here are the directions. Step 1. Heat oven to 425 degrees Fahrenheit. Cook pasta per package directions. Reserve 1/2 cup cooking liquid, then drain and rinse pasta. Return to pot. Step 2. Meanwhile, arrange bacon on large rimmed baking sheet and roast, stirring halfway through until golden brown and crisp, 7 to 9 minutes. Step 3. Sprinkle shallots, garlic, and thyme over bacon and toss to combine, and then toss with 1 1/2 teaspoons of pepper. Add mushrooms to the pan, season with 1/2 teaspoon of salt, and stir until evenly mixed. Spread mixture in pan in an even layer. Roast, stirring twice until mushrooms are golden brown and tender. Takes 20 to 25 minutes. Step 4, transfer mushroom mixture and spinach to pasta pot, and then immediately add sherry to the baking sheet and scrape up any caramelized bits on the pan. Add sherry and bits to pot and toss to combine, adding reserved cooking liquid if pasta seems dry, then toss with parsley. The addition of bacon to this roasted wild mushroom pasta adds a salty and slightly sweet addition to the dish, complementing the more woodsy taste of mushrooms. In culture news, we have all about Samantha's brief but memorable return to And Just Like That. Our favorite PR maven came back like she never left. Blink and you'd miss her, but Samantha Jones is still back. Kim Cattrall made her long-awaited cameo during the season 2 finale of Max's And Just Like That on Thursday, and even though her appearance was brief, it was the moment longtime fans of the series had been patiently waiting for. Rather than drawing out Samantha's cameo until the end of the episode, AJLT's writers wasted no time. PR maven Samantha Jones appeared in the first scene of the season 2 finale, calling Carrie from the back of a cab, apologizing that she wouldn't make her Last Supper dinner party to toast her leaving her beloved apartment. It turns out even Samantha is just like us. Her flight from Heathrow was canceled due to her flight being understaffed. She called Carrie to send her well wishes for her new start in her new home, however, and bid adieu to the apartment via speakerphone. Thank you for everything. You've
"You're fabulous, fabulous flat," she said in signature Samantha fashion, and then she was gone. Kudos to Cattrall for orchestrating one of the most anticipated and assumedly highest paid 60-second cameos in recent television history. Of course, Cattrall revealed earlier this year during a visit on talk show The View that she filmed her cameo separately for the rest of the cast, a condition she voiced to HBO before agreeing to revisit the fan-favorite character. She also requested that Sex and the City's famed stylist Patricia Field, who does not currently work on the costuming for AJLT, return to style her character as well, of which Field obliged, considering the pair's close friendship. It's very interesting to get a call from the head of HBO saying, "What can we do?" And I went, Cattrall said previously, "Let me get creative," and one of those things was to get Pat Field back, because I just thought that if I'm going to come back, I gotta come back with that Samantha style. I gotta push it. And we did. The show's creator, Michael Patrick King, also spoke to Forbes ahead of Samantha's return and described the poorly kept surprise as the ultimate gift for longtime fans to mark the original series' 25th anniversary. "It's a great treat for the fans. What you'll see, I'm not going to tell you because I'm mad you even know that you're going to see it, because my goal was to keep it a secret as much as we did Big's death, but didn't happen," King explained. "It kind of magically just appeared. It was fun to write Samantha again. It's great to see her in the show." And we're going to put in one of Oprah's favorite things, Laurel and Ash Farm Limited Edition Maple Syrup Gift Box. It sells for $65 at Amazon. "Use this maple syrup to sweeten beverages on top of pancakes and waffles or on plain Greek yogurt. Just as great, it comes in such a statement-making box, I wouldn't even bother wrapping it." And one more, Comparte's Treasures of the Orchard Chocolate Gift Box. "You know I love a good produce haul, so when I saw that this family-owned chocolate company was taking California-grown fruits, like apricots, strawberries, and more, and dipping them in chocolate for this gift box, I just had to include it on my list." And it sells for $60 at Amazon, and it's spelled Comparte's is the name of the company. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.